Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. We live in a fast food nation. This year, 96% of Americans will eat fast food at least once. That's more than those who will go to the gym or to a house of worship or even who will use the internet. Fast food restaurants get their fair share of criticism for paying workers low wages, for poor treatment of animals, and for food that often has very dubious nutritional value. But these establishments also occupy a supersized place in our hearts as places where Americans meet and gather with members of their community. This hour on Point, a journey through the heart of America's fast food kingdom. And you can join us. What memories do you have of fast food restaurants or even the ones that you visit and love today? What role does fast food play in your life? And do you think it gets a bad rap or does it deserve that bad rap? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And a little later this hour, by the way, we're going to also be talking about the first Democratic presidential debates that happened last night. Here's a little taste.
This is not about policy. This is personal.
That was Democratic Senator and presidential hopeful Cory Booker. So in the last third of the show, we will talk about the debates. But first, joining us now from New York is Adam Chandler. He is a writer and journalist and author of the new book, Drive Through Dreams, A Journey Through the Heart of America's Fast Food Kingdom. You can find an excerpt of the book at onpointradio.org. Adam, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
You know, in just reading your book and thinking about this conversation today, it actually fostered a lot of wonderful memories I have of eating at fast food restaurants growing up. My visiting those establishments has dropped a little in my adulthood. But why did you want to write this book?
Kind of for the same reasons. I have nostalgic memories of growing up in Texas, and there's a regional chain there called Whataburger, which every Texan will tell you is the greatest thing on earth. And I used to go there with my friends in high school, and we would eat these really, really delicious things called breakfast taquitos right before we went to bed every night, right before we went home for our curfews on weekend nights. And it was a sacred ritual to us. So I think everyone kind of has these stories.
Yeah, but not so much now where you live?
Now I live in Brooklyn, where it is not exactly easy to feel the same way about fast food without getting some judgment. So I think the divides between those two are really interesting, Texas and Brooklyn or certain parts of the country. It's controversial. It's polarizing.
Yeah.
And that's a really fascinating divide.
Yeah, it is polarizing, controversial, and people can be quite judgmental about it. But when we look upon how Americans eat fast food broadly, I mean, I quoted that number about 96% of Americans will eat fast food at least once this year. I mean, people are still lots of Americans still regularly enjoy it.
Absolutely. On a given day, over a third of Americans will eat fast food, which is an amazing statistic and startling in some ways. But it is true. People love it. People love it for its convenience, for its familiarity, for the value, and they love it as a place to go. And I think that that's always been a part of the equation and probably always will be.
Yeah. So tell me, you actually took this very interesting trip to do some research and visit a lot of fast food establishments in the writing of this book. Tell us, where did you start and where did you end up?
Okay. So I started at the Gulf of Mexico and I drove all the way to the Great Lakes. These are America's two unsung coasts, where I figured a different conversation about fast food happens. And so I met workers, I met franchise owners, I met super fans, and I ate my face off in unbelievable forms, unbelievable capacities. I actually didn't put on as much weight as I thought I would, but if there was something out there that seemed strange and interesting to me, I tried it. And it was an amazing snapshot of what America has to offer in its fast food kingdom.
So, any favorite meal?
I definitely had a favorite meal, basically just a morning brunch at a McDonald's in a rural Kansas town. And it was this really beautiful moment where people were pouring in before church. People were coming in maybe a little worse for wear from the night before. a real collection of people. That's one of my favorite aspects of fast food is how democratic it is. You see people from all walks of life, all ages, all demographics kind of in the same place and sharing a meal, which is intimate. And that's not a normal thing anymore. It's hard to find places where everyone comes together. And so that experience really resonated with me.
Yeah. So it's interesting that in many communities, these fast food restaurants, as you're just saying, serve as de facto community spaces, right? I mean, and also there are places in which, even though they're connected to corporations, if they're community spaces, it's sort of a non-judgmental community space. You can sort of be anyone coming off the street, grab your meals, sit down and sit next to your neighbor.
Absolutely. We think of fast food often as impersonal and corporate, but really the ubiquity of fast food kind of gives it this familiarity, and you will see things that you don't expect to see. Bible study groups and father-daughter dates and little league teams coming in. It really is an intimate community center that you may not think of as a place that offers that, but it really does if you hang around long enough.
Yeah. You know, through the course of our conversation, Adam, you're going to have to forgive me because occasionally I'm going to try and like I'm going to poke holes in our nostalgic view of fast
sure.
food here.
I can't tell you it is a perfect entity, although, you know, certain items at Taco Bell are inherently perfect. The institution itself is not above criticism by any stretch of the imagination. I definitely talk about that a lot in the book because those divides are important. You know, how we talk about food and wages and the way people live. It is important to sort of talk about it, and fast food is a really great way to open up all these issues.
Well, so that's one of the things that your book, I think, very interestingly illuminates for us is how the story of fast food as a business really mirrors sort of the transformation of the American economy. Once, you know, in favor of workers to decidedly against workers. And I'm going to get to that in a second. But about these community spaces that the restaurants may serve as, like, I really love that notion. And those are some of my fondest memories when I was a kid and I'd like ride my bike down to the McDonald's and give them my quarter back when you can buy a burger for a quarter. But on the other hand, part of the issue is they're serving as community spaces because in a lot of these places where the fast food restaurants are, as you point out, they're also food deserts. So that may be the only restaurant option or of the limited restaurant options that people have. And that's a problem.
Right. Absolutely. They are places of first and last resort. And there are incredible stories out there of, you know, people who don't have access to the internet who go to a fast food restaurant to do their homework or to apply for jobs. And it's a place for people who are struggling through semi-homelessness or need a place to hang out to go to. And there really is no barrier to entry there. And that's meaningful because in a lot of ways it fills in the roles that aren't occupied by government institutions in quite the same way. For seniors in particular, fast food restaurants are a place to hang out that offer intergenerational mingling. You know, you're not sectioned off by age at a senior center and you're not stuck in the basement of a library. You are with everyone. And there's something about that I think a lot of people derive meaning from.
Well, actually, let's go to a call now if we could. Mike is calling from Framingham, Massachusetts. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I wanted to share a fast food experience I had as a young man in high school. I had a hot rod Mustang, and on Friday night or Saturday night after a football game at the high school, this was almost right out of American Graffiti. You would drive up to Crestwood, Missouri, and go along the boulevard there, and there would be a Steak and Shake restaurant that had twinkly lights that went around the rim of it, and it gave the appearance the lights were circling the building. It had a horseshoe driveway that went around the back of it. If you were lucky enough to get in there and find a spot, you'd park your hot rod or your car back in. All around the horseshoe were hot rods. I'm talking Model T buckets, 32 deuces.
Yeah.
The girls that worked there would come out on roller skates. This was before rollerblades. Put a tray on your window, take your order, and you'd wait. The burgers were so good. If you went inside and watched the cooks make them, they used two spatulas. They would throw a piece of real beef, ground beef, on the grill with two spatulas. They would smash that thing flat, fry it up, flip it over, it was so lean that the meat was actually somewhat dry.
Well,
it would have, you'd cruise from Steak and Shake down to White Castle, circle White Castle, drive back up the boulevard to McDonald's, circle that, back to Steak and Shake, and you did this all night, hoping to find your friends, meet a girl maybe. It was really neat. It was cool.
Yeah.
It was a bygone time that's, you know, no longer there.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for your call. And in just your description, I feel like I stepped into almost a movie. It was so cinematic, your description, Mike. Adam Chandler, Mike says that's a bygone time. Is it really? Or are there still places where that kind of, you know, going from place to place and the quality of the food, you can still find that in fast food restaurants?
Mike, that was an incredible story. I love it so much. I think you do see that in different forms. A lot of it is not necessarily the hot rods, although they do have a lot of meetups happen for car owners who have really impressive old vehicles show up in parking lots of McDonald's around the country. There's one in California that's the oldest operating McDonald's. It's in Downey, California, and it looks like a postcard from the 1950s. And if you go there on the right day, you will see a bunch of car owners pulling up these unbelievable cars with huge tail fins and just hanging out and having a hamburger. So it exists in a small, fleeting kind of way. But in a certain way, it also still exists because it's still a teen hangout. It's still a place for people to go when there isn't somewhere else to go necessarily. You just kind of want to be somewhere. So it's definitely not the way it once was. And the burgers may not be quite as fresh depending on where you are, but that paradigm still exists.
Yeah. Well, Adam, we have to take a break in a couple seconds. But very briefly, when you talk about fast food today, are we talking about burgers and fried chicken? Or are we also talking about, you know, fast casual and the Chipotle kind of thing?
I'm strictly a combo meal, sketchy ball pit kind of fast food fan. I think fast casual is a little too expensive and a little too exclusive than your normal fast food restaurant. So I kind of discount that.
So those $14 fast salads out. Okay, so Adam Chandler, author of Drive Through Dreams, A Journey Through the Heart of America's Fast Food Kingdom. Stand by. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking with Adam Chandler today. He's author of the new book, Drive Through Dreams, A Journey Through the Heart of America's Fast Food Kingdom. And Adam, I just want to play a little bit of tape here. We're about to hear the voice of Colonel Harlan Sanders. He is the founder of now KFC, once Kentucky Fried Chicken. In 1956, he sold his then business at a loss after a series of highway construction projects bypassed his restaurants. Now, that left him with only his savings and a $105 per month Social Security check. Again, this was 1956. So Sanders started franchising his pressure cooker method and recipe for chicken at 4 cents for every chicken cooked via his process. And he told what happened then. He told a story in a 1979 interview with the PTL television network.
I started franchising in earnest when I was 66 years old. I just say the moral to my life, don't quit at age 65. Maybe your boat hasn't come in yet. Mine hasn't. By golly, I finally got up to where I had an income of $1,000 a day, don't you see?
It's Colonel Harlan Sanders in 1979. Adam Chandler, I wanted to play that because you raise a really interesting aspect of fast food in your book. And that is, you know, today there's a lot of focus on these big corporations as being, you know, sustaining themselves on the suppressed wages and low wages of workers and not providing a living wage. But you make the argument that 50 years ago, fast food was kind of a bootstrapping way to realize the American dream. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Absolutely. In this really quaint kind of American dream idea, the fast food founders all share these really impressive biographical attributes. Colonel Sanders is a perfect example. He grew up in poverty in Kentucky, and he basically struggled for his entire career, basically creating a fried chicken recipe while he was operating a gas station in southeastern Kentucky during the Great Depression. He actually shot a man that he had a gas station feud with, which is another wild story of his. And he didn't succeed until late in life. But his story is of someone who committed to national service. He was in the Army. He was a middle school dropout. And he just kept pecking away at it. And not that chicken pun meant to happen, but it did. And he made it. He made it. And late in life, he became a millionaire several times over. And fast food is full of stories like this. Dave Thomas of Wendy's fame was one of his proteges. And he was an orphan who also had to take up work when he was 12 years old living in Indiana and struggled and eventually found his way into the business. For Boston area listeners, you probably know the story of Dunkin' Donuts. William Rosenberg was a middle school dropout. He delivered telegrams for Western Union, and he was an electrician for Bethlehem Steel before he started Dunkin' Donuts. You know, you don't get more American stories than that. And so the origins of fast food all have this very sort of old-fashioned Horatio Alger kind of background to it that is really compelling and also seems kind of quaint when you look back at it.
Mm. You also write about how franchisees were able to realize, you know, their version of the American dream too. Tell us more about that.
Right. So Ray Kroc in particular, who is the famous McDonald's founder, depending on who you ask, he sought out people who were hungry and didn't have MBAs and weren't pedigreed, who just wanted to work really hard and plug in a system to create franchises. And a lot of people you ask, you read enough about it, they will say Ray Kroc made more millionaires in America than anyone else. This is part of a fast food trope of small business owners kind of coming up in an era of prosperity, the 50s and 60s, when there was a baby boom and the suburbs are growing and people were moving in cars on newly built highways and they needed a place to eat. And fast food very much filled that niche. So it's a very American story.
And there's one particular, I'm trying to remember. Oh, yeah. Aslam Khan, a Pakistani immigrant who started as a dishwasher and went on to become the largest franchisee of a particular fast food chain. Remind us of him. I'm not sure if I remember his whole story very well.
His story is incredible. He grew up in northwest Pakistan in a village with no running water and no electricity. And he left home when he was 14. And eventually worked at the U.S. Embassy as a waiter and emigrated to the United States. And he tried to apply for a job as a district manager at a Church's Chicken. And they didn't look too kindly on him. This sort of his experiences weren't meaningful to him. So he started as a dishwasher. And he has this great quote. He said, "It took me 18 years to get to America, and it took me 13 years to become a millionaire." He worked his way up from dishwasher to manager, to regional manager, to district manager. And then he bought all of these franchises and he turned them into a juggernaut. So he's this really fantastic immigrant story that we really love. It's about America's promise. And you talk to him, he talks about America in this way that really feels old-fashioned but also inspiring. You want to believe that America is still this land where you can really arrive with nothing in your pockets, work really hard, and make it happen. Yeah. And he absolutely believes it's true.
Well, and so here I come along, ripping off those rose-colored lenses again, because, I mean, all these stories are true. And especially, I love the idea of franchisees who don't have MBAs being given access to becoming business people through the ownership of fast food restaurants. But now we're in a world where, you know, tens of thousands of employees at these places are struggling because they're not earning a living wage. Their working conditions are tough. They're working multiple jobs. And so it seems as if the persistence of the model of the economy around a fast food restaurant is relying on suppressing the very workers who once could have benefited from, you know, being part of these businesses.
Right. That's absolutely true and extremely unfortunate. It is something that has become a norm. We talk about fast food work as something the perception is, you know, teenagers, the trope, the cultural trope in movies is, you know, teenagers slaving away, trying to sort of sort out their lives and working a fast food job. And there are a lot of stories that kind of back that up. Jeff Bezos is the richest man in the world, and he worked at McDonald's. Lin-Manuel Miranda, Rahm Emanuel, famously sliced off his middle finger at an Arby's. Paul Ryan, Queen Latifah, Pink, all of these really huge celebrities have these stories of working in fast food restaurants as sort of character building moments on their way to great fame and fortune. And we don't hear that the same way anymore. Today, the average fast food worker is 26 years old. And part of that has to do with teens dropping out of the workforce. And a lot of that has to do with limited opportunity because of wage stagnation and income inequality and a lot of these issues that really kind of pass through fast food when we talk about America today.
Mm. Well, let's go back to our callers. Let's go to Nicholas, who's calling from Burlington, Vermont. Nicholas, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that, you know, I think we're living through and have been for a while a second Gilded Age in this country. And there's a lot of, I think, fast food and the advent of fast food restaurants has been a symptom of the economic squeezing that's going on of working folks, both the people that have limited budgets and limited time and are relying on fast food for regular meals and nutrition, and then the folks that actually work there that are often working multiple shifts, you know, more than 40 hours a week. And it's just a symptom of a lot of economic squeezing and hardship that's going on in this country that really doesn't need to be happening. Thanks.
Yeah. Nicholas, thank you so much for that call. Let's go to Teddy, who's calling from Yellow Springs, Ohio. Teddy, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. My experience with fast food is interesting from the point of view that I grew up on a farm, basically, outside of Yellow Springs, where we slaughtered our own cattle and chickens and picked our own garden, and we were all part of the meal-making process. And once I moved into Yellow Springs, I couldn't wait to be part of the fast food community, going to Grody's and the Tasty Freeze for a quick burger or a hot dog, which you couldn't get at the house. Then I started working there. Once I started working at those places, all of a sudden I got completely turned off by the whole fast food situation, because none of it was from the farms. None of it was from the area that none of it was fresh. And I was probably making $1.25 an hour. Okay, well, now I'm 56 and I have friends in their 70s. And they're working at fast food restaurants after their careers are over with, trying to supplement their income. Now, I'm not trying to dog the fast food industry. It was very, very exciting for a while, and it probably has still a lot of excitement for those people who own stock in it.
Yeah.
But it's a shame that you still can't go in there and make minimum wage. I think they're making my friend's making $7.90 an hour.
Wow. Well, Teddy, I'm going to take it back from you there. Thank you so much for your call. Adam Chandler, do you want to respond to what Teddy said?
Yeah, these are really great and important points. You can't overlook that these issues over wages and labor are a huge problem. And I have to tell you, my experience is when I first moved to New York, I was a bartender for 6 years. And the issues that plague fast food are issues that plague the entire restaurant industry, which I think is an interesting distinction to make. Insecure scheduling, you're working for a tipped wage, which is less than the minimum wage. So if no one shows up on a rainy day or you work the day after the Super Bowl, you're going to walk away with maybe $15 or $20 for an eight-hour shift. And there are several issues, sexual harassment, wage garnishing, all kinds of things that happen that affect the entire restaurant industry. There are no benefits. There are no sick days. So I do think it's important to highlight the issues in fast food, but I also want to point out that these are issues that are across the entire restaurant industry. So it's important not to scapegoat fast food necessarily, but to use it as a way to talk about the entire system, because it's useful to know that if you're making a choice to not eat fast food and go to another restaurant, you really have to look closely at what they're doing as well, because it's really a systemic problem.
So why is it then, though, that fast food gets so much of the attention when we're taking a critical lens to the restaurant industry?
It's only natural. It's such a huge target. The footprint is so huge. Everyone knows it. There's such a familiar sense about it. They're ubiquitous. And so when you talk about America, you can talk about fast food as a shorthand for a lot of the problems. And what a lot of people don't realize is that certain franchise owners are often small business owners, men and women who are running small businesses, you know, in partnership with corporations. And so it's not often seen as mom and pop shops, but in a lot of ways it is. So I think that that's a lot of what it has to do with.
Let's get a couple more calls here. Let's go to Michael, who's calling from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Mingo. My comment, I'll try to be super brief. I actually work a couple of shifts a week at Starbucks. And so I guess my concern is mostly about the caloric intake and the sugar content, the sodium content. I see people come in day after day ordering the same food, and I just am super worried about the health effects of people taking in this kind of food each and every day.
Yeah.
The other thing is, locally, there are some fast food, I guess I would call them, options that are super healthy. I go to a place that serves fresh poke bowls. I go to a juice, fresh squeezed juice bar. And I wonder if that is just a new way of thinking about fast food. Can we create, you know, sub-classifications of fast food, a.k.a. junk, or fast food, a.k.a. still healthy and a viable option?
Yes. Great question, Michael. So thanks for your call. Adam, should we be expanding our view of fast food to smoothies and salads and poke bowls?
Well, there aren't poke bowls, thank God, I think, at fast food restaurants yet. But salads and smoothies are coming in. And what I think is interesting about fast food broadly, and I talk a lot about this in the book, is it's a reflection of the American mainstream. So the way that people eat, you know, it doesn't always happen right away. It's always a few years behind. But if you think about it, millions of Americans are going to have their first cage-free eggs in an Egg McMuffin. You know, that's something that McDonald's has done in response to consumer demands. A lot of Americans, millions, are going to have their first plant-based burger by way of an Impossible Whopper at Burger King or an Impossible Slider at White Castle. So really, fast food kind of moves in step with the mainstream. And so I would expect that as diets change, there will be really fascinating movements along the way. Kentucky Fried Chicken is a really great example because it used to be called Kentucky Fried Chicken. And in the 1990s, the word fried became such a polarizing, difficult word to hear that they actually legally shortened their name to KFC. So there are marketing moves and there are actual tangible moves that are happening to sort of respond to these changes in American diets.
Yeah,
so I think fast food's part of the equation.
I'm glad that you differentiated marketing moves from actual tangible moves, because changing your name to KFC doesn't obviate the process by which that C is being made.
Look, absolutely not.
We've got about two minutes left, Adam. And I just wanted to ask you to help us close this conversation with what I think is one of your favorite stories from the book, and that's about Doritos Locos Tacos. Can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. So the creation of the Doritos Locos Taco is one of the great invention stories. It could not be more of an invention story. A man named Todd Mills in Arkansas was sitting watching a Doritos commercial while eating a Taco Bell taco. And he always ate taco salads with Doritos in them. But that day he had this moment of, oh my God, this is it. And he thought Taco Bell needs to be serving tacos made with Dorito-flavored shells. And so he wrote a letter to Frito-Lay and said, you guys need to make Doritos-flavored taco shells. And Frito-Lay did not take him seriously, as most corporations probably wouldn't. So he started a Facebook group, and he would use his Photoshop skills to create these little tableaus of pictures of these taco shells next to the Mona Lisa at the Louvre or in the hands of Chuck Norris doing a flying ninja kick. And they went viral back in the age where something going viral on Facebook actually meant something. So as Taco Bell was moving towards its 50th anniversary, this idea had already existed in Taco Bell's sort of backlog of ideas, but it got shelved. And so for the 50th anniversary, they decided to go ahead and they saw this guy, Todd Mills, and they decided this is our champion. This is our spokesman. So they invited him to the Taco Bell HQ to try the very first Doritos Locos Taco. They had a mariachi band waiting for him. And years later, 100 million tacos were served. 10 weeks, 100 million tacos made by Dorito shells, created 15,000 jobs and is now a juggernaut. So it's an incredible story of love for Taco Bell.
You share that love, I gather, right?
I do share that love. Much to my own personal detriment, I share that love.
Well, Adam Chandler, author of the new book, Drive Through Dreams, A Journey Through the Heart of America's Fast Food Kingdom. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, when we come back, we'll take a look at last night's first Democratic presidential debate and look ahead to what's coming up tonight. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Last night, 10 Democratic presidential hopefuls took to the stage in Miami, Florida for the first televised debate of this presidential campaign season. They talked about gun control, immigration, health care. A few also spoke Spanish. The second round of candidates take the stage tonight, and we're looking at what we learned from last night and what to expect from this evening's debates. And you can join us. What did you make of the first round of Democratic debates? What candidates caught your eye and why? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And let's just listen to one little moment here from last night's debate. And you'll hear Washington Governor Jay Inslee talking about why he thinks insurance companies should not have the option to deny women coverage for exercising their reproductive rights. And Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar has a pointed response.
I am the only candidate here who has passed a law protecting a woman's right of reproductive health and health insurance. And I'm the only candidate who has passed a public option. And I respect everybody's goals and plans here. But we do have one candidate that's actually advanced the ball. And we got to have access for everyone. I've done it
your
as a public
time
option.
Is up, Governor. Senator Klobuchar, I want to get you. I'm fascinated by this, Senator Klobuchar.
I just want to say there's three women up here that have fought pretty hard for a woman's right to choose. So I'll start with that.
A moment from last night's first Democratic presidential debate. Well, joining us now from Miami is Lisa Lehrer, reporter at The New York Times, covering campaigns, elections, and political power. She writes the On Politics with Lisa Lehrer newsletter. Lisa, it's great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so any standouts from the first 10 we saw on stage last night?
The first 10, right? This is going to be, the first debate, and we're in for a long election. That seems clear if the first debate starts off with a total of 4 hours of debating. And 20 candidates. But I think we'd be remiss if we didn't mention Elizabeth Warren. I think it was really striking how much she led the policy debate. The first section of this debate was basically candidates being questioned on whether they agreed with her policies she had put out on a variety of issues. And she, of course, came out in favor of Medicare for All, eliminating a difference she had had with Bernie Sanders. And then I think the other person who really deserves a mention here is Julian Castro. He's mm-hmm. someone that has lingered at the bottom of the polls. He was the first candidate to announce after Delaney, I believe. He announced in January, in early January. And he really hasn't gotten much traction in the race, but it will be interesting to see if that changes. We know, based on some metrics that we pull, that he did really well in search. His Google searches were up 4,000%. So people were definitely interested in him. And I think what he did was he talked very strongly about policy that's really been a centerpiece of his campaign, which is immigration. That's, of course, something that's been in the news with these reports of the horrific conditions that some of the children migrants have been held in. And he also talked about it not only in a way that presented his policy, but in a way that was very, very passionate and really showed some of his personality. Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see whether this bump is durable. I think that's a really open question with so many candidates on the stage and another night tonight
right.
with another 10 candidates, whether anyone can really change the trajectory of their campaign out of one of these events.
I have to say, Lisa, I'm a little disappointed to hear that that Julian Castro's Google searches went up 4,000% last night and not after we had him on point for an hour several weeks ago.
I'm sorry to break that news. I think, you know, I'm really curious, but it does allude to a different point. I'm really curious how many people actually watch this debate. I just think it's a lot to ask of voters to do 4 hours of televised debating with so many candidates 6 months before anyone even cast the first ballot in this primary. So we'll get those ratings this afternoon, and I think it'll be interesting. And it also, you know, I heard from some of the campaigns whose candidates are going tonight, and they're watching last night and seeing what lessons they can take. And one of the things several people told me is that you want to make an impact in the first half an hour or so, because there is a concern that people just sort of watch the beginning and then turn out the TV. I don't know. It was a late night for me, but I have little kids, so I go to bed early. I don't know. Maybe
same
other people
here.
Are better night owls. You know, they could go the distance.
Well, to be fair, on the West Coast, it was only 6 o'clock when the debate started.
Right.
But I want to. So you mentioned Castro and Warren, and let's just hear a little bit from some moments in the debate where they spoke. Here, you're going to actually hear two Texans, Julian Castro and Beto O'Rourke, sparring over the question of immigration. More specifically, Section 1325 of the U.S. Code, which Julian Castro brought up. That's the one that regulates improper entry into the United States and the part of U.S. law that the Trump administration is looking to justify its zero tolerance policy that has led to a lot of these child separations. And so Castro criticized former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke for not calling for that section's appeal. And here's Castro.
I think it's a mistake. And I think that if you truly want to change the system, then we got to repeal that section. If not,
thank you.
Then it might as well be the same policy.
Let me respond to this very briefly. Actually, as a member of Congress, I helped to introduce legislation that would ensure that we don't criminalize those who are seeking asylum and refuge in this country. If you're fleeing desperation, I want to make sure that you're treated with respect.
I'm still talking about everybody else.
But you're looking at just one small part of this. I'm talking about a comprehensive rewrite of our immigration
laws.
That's
not true. And
O'Rourke told CNN earlier this month, by the way, that he, quote, did not think Section 1325 should be repealed. Lisa Lehrer, so what's interesting about that moment is that we have Julian Castro, who, as you were saying, you know, might have caught a lot of people's attention last night, but intentionally pushing against Beto O'Rourke, who, you know, seemed to be the darling of the media for quite some time.
There's two things going on in that exchange that are worth discussing. The first is from a policy standpoint. You know, this is not an issue that has come up all that heavily in the race so far. There's been plenty of things that have been sort of litmus tests, you know, the Green New Deal or healthcare. Those are things that people are talking about. Abortion even came up with Joe Biden's record on the Hyde Amendment. Those are things that the candidates are being asked about and talking about. This section of the immigration law hasn't really come up. So it'll be interesting to see if now this becomes another litmus test in the race. I wouldn't be surprised if the candidates tonight are asked about Section 1325. So that's one piece of it. Now, the other piece is the politics. Texas is a really big state. I'm not sure the 2020 race is big enough to accommodate two Texans. Mm. And Beto O'Rourke is someone who has a following with Latino voters. He's someone who that community feels an affinity with. Julian Castro needs to cut into that demographic. So I think that's part of why you saw him taking such a direct aim at Beto O'Rourke. And Beto O'Rourke really needed to do – you're right. He entered the race with a lot of fanfare, a lot of media attention. But he's seen his numbers in the polls sort of drop in recent weeks. And in part, that's because he had this period where he had really announced his campaign but didn't have much of an operation. So he was traveling the country and he was doing events. And he didn't have anyone telling him, like, well, in a presidential race, these cable news town halls really matter to get your message out. It's not just the same thing right. as running a successful, fairly, ultimately unsuccessful, but fairly popular Texas Senate race. So I think he lost some momentum because of that interim period. But I'm not sure the race is set in June, and he has time, I think, to regain that. But I don't think he particularly helped his case in last night's debate.
Well, let's take a quick call. Marty's calling from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Marty, you're on the air.
Thanks for having me. From a candidate aspect, I thought Castro performed very well. He was composed. He argued his points very well, and I really appreciated his passion and his personality. But my question is this: what do we have to do as a society to create a debate that's organized, composed, well orchestrated, that doesn't have the overspeaking, the cross talking? I mean, it's almost embarrassing to sit here as a Democrat and listen to what I thought was going to be a more professional debate become kind of a chaotic interaction of people screaming.
Hmm. Well, Marty, thank you so much for your call. Lisa, what do you think? I think it's tough to manage a debate with 10 candidates on the stage.
Yeah, it's really tough to manage a debate with 10 candidates. And I think it was tough for the candidates themselves to manage the format. And I think that's part of why you saw some of these candidates who have a more storytelling kind of style, like a Cory Booker or a Beto O'Rourke, struggle to kind of get their points in those tight frames. But Marty raises the question: how do you manage a debate with 10 candidates? I mean, really, we're dealing with 20 candidates. Mm-hmm. Is back to back the right way to do it? Do you let them do opening statements? They did not last night, because that would have taken a whole lot of time. I was at an event in Iowa, in Cedar Rapids, in Marty's hometown, where they had 19 of the Democratic candidates each give 5-minute speeches at a party event. And that is a lot of time, and it's a lot of candidates. And I think it's hard to ensure that everyone gets a chance. And there's certainly candidates who will feel that they didn't get enough time, or that their issues weren't brought up enough. I wouldn't be surprised if we hear some about climate change. I don't think that topic came up till about 80 minutes in, and it's something that much of the Democratic base feels very strongly about. So, I think any way you do this with 10 candidates, you're going to get criticism.
Yeah.
It's just a hard nut to crack.
Well, so a couple of minutes ago, Lisa, you talked about Elizabeth Warren and her strong performance last night. Let's listen to a moment here. One of the moderators asked which candidates were in favor of abolishing private insurance companies, and Senator Warren raised her hand, saying that the business model for private insurance leaves families with rising premiums making it even tougher to get the health care they need. And then Senator Warren went on to say this:
Medicare for all solves that problem. And I understand there are a lot of politicians who say, oh, it's just not possible. We just can't do it. It's have a lot of political reasons for this. What they're really telling you is they just won't fight for it.
So, Lisa, how much did it help Senator Warren that, as you said, a lot of the first part of the debate was a discussion about essentially around the policies that she's already put out?
Right. Her team went with the strategy that they would go policy heavy and turn out these policies early and fast. And I think it's proven to be, at least at this stage in the race, a fairly successful strategy, because one of the biggest challenges these candidates face is getting airtime, not only with 24 or 25 candidates in the field, but also with President Trump, who just eats up all media attention. He just consumes it, you know, and it's really hard for candidates to break through. One way they're able to do that is through policy, that when they announce a new policy, they're likely to get some coverage. And Elizabeth Warren did that in such a way that she tackled a lot of the major areas, and a lot of the other candidates are sort of been scrambling to catch up with her. Mm. And it's become a tagline, right? You hear her supporters say she has a plan for that. It's become sort of her calling card, and it's something that certainly a portion of the Democratic primary feels strikes a very nice contrast with President Trump.
Yeah, it's interesting that we're talking about Senator Warren a lot and not that much about Amy Klobuchar. So maybe we'll get to we'll talk about her in the hopefully coming days and weeks here. But I want to let at least one more of our callers in. Laura is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Laura, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Go ahead.
I thought it was a great opportunity to actually hear what they had to say, and I was really pleased to see how articulate most of the candidates were. Not all, certainly, but it's hard to believe hype that you see in candidates. And so unless you actually get to see them speak in a debate forum, it's hard to really know who they are, what they stand for. Are they articulate? Are they thoughtful? And even if it's time-consuming and it's not ideal because there's so many people on the stage, it's so important as, you know, part of being part of the democracy to listen to how these folks think, because mm-hmm. the problems we have to solve are really complex.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just one big problem. It's a lot of big problems, and they're so systemic that you really need somebody to get creative and thoughtful about how to solve things.
Right. And Laura, and so I hear you saying that the debates are a chance to at least begin to hear what their solutions would be. Thank you so much for your call. Lisa, we've got about 2.5 minutes left here. Let's look ahead to what is coming tonight. We'll have Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Pete Buttigieg, Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand, Michael Bennett, Marianne Williamson, Eric Swalwell, Andrew Yang, and John Hickenlooper on the stage. Do you care to give us your predictions on what we might see?
Well, I think we're going to see candidates come out harder earlier, just because I think they watched tonight's debate and saw that to have an impact, you need to, you know, be crisp and tight and have that line as early as possible. I also think we'll hear a lot more about President Trump. One thing that struck me last night was how little time was spent discussing President Trump when, you know, we know from polling, from interviews, from just being out at events with Democratic primary voters that the overwhelming concern that primary voters have is finding someone who is electable, that mythical quality. They don't exactly know what it looks like. Everyone has a different definition, but that is what they want, someone who can beat President Trump. And that's really where Joe Biden has focused his campaign and his message, as presenting himself as the person who can, you know, in his words, take it to President Trump. So I think we'll hear a lot more about the president. And I also think Joe Biden and his team are bracing for him to come under some criticism. He, of course, is the front runner in this race, at least at this early stage, if you can say there's a front runner 6 months before. So I think they're expecting criticism of his record. He has a 4-decades-long record in Washington. And I wonder if we'll hear some more of a generational contrast because, of course, Biden and Bernie Sanders in their late 70s, and you have Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who's the youngest person in the race. And he's really been running on this message of generational change. So we may hear more sort of coded, or who knows, maybe not so coded language around age.
Mm. And I have to say, my apologies to Senator Gillibrand, because I keep transposing the I and the R in her name. It's Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. I'm not going to make that mistake again. Lisa Lehrer, reporter for the New York Times, covering campaigns, elections, and political power. And she writes the On Politics with Lisa Lehrer newsletter with us today from Miami. Lisa, I hope you have another good night tonight. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, and Grace Tatter, with help from Alex Reese and Sydney Wertheim. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman, actually. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and you can see I'm a day away from a 2-week vacation, which I'll put you all at your ease. I definitely need. I'll be much better when I come back. So thanks for bearing with me. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.